certainly appreciate the kindness of the friend who prepared these flower arrangements. It certainly adds a great deal to the pleasure of these occasions. This evening, we must conclude our all-too-brief survey of the works of Theophrastus Paracelsus. I won't confuse it, it's much too long. We have many, many fields that we'd like to briefly mention and hope to cover as much ground as we can. It is regrettable that sufficient time and study cannot be devoted to so important a theme. But by way of introduction, we hope that these talks will cause students to take a personal interest in research on the Paracelsian corpus, which is a great body of work. We'd like to mention in passing, in connection with the concept of universal sympathy, that Paracelsus used the term imagination in a rather mystical and almost oriental manner. To him, the word imagination contained within the heart of itself the word magic. And to him, the power of the imaginative faculty was something of such tremendous importance that he regarded it as the most dynamic factor in human consciousness. He felt that by imagination, the human being came nearer to attaining freedom, to advancing individual and collective growth, than by almost any other means. Imagination is man moving away from himself, out of the commonplace, escaping from the boundaries and barriers of tradition and authority, creating. Therefore, he made great point of the importance of training imagination in the divine magic of the universe. He held that imagination, more than reason, was the hope of humanity. All good things begin as dreams, and extending themselves in uncharted directions, are sustained by the tremendous creative vitality of man's mental and emotional complex. He held, therefore, that imagination is more than the individual creating. It is the individual coming into sympathetic relationship with creation itself. Under the law of sympathy, Paracelsus outlined the concept of divine imagination. If man can imagine the universe, he can experience it. Imagination is a magnificent bridge by which the individual can come into sympathy with the future, restore the past, and broaden the frontiers of the present day. To reach out by imagination toward truth is to discover new and useful things. Therefore, the test of creative imagination is that it forms a dream under which science can build a foundation. No great creative thinker, no great scientist, philosopher, or theologian can be deficient in imagination. Without it, we are slaves to what is already achieved. With it, we build upon achievement, expanding it forever into the great world of universals. For imagination is like a miner who is digging out of the unknown earth of space precious ideas, coming gradually to learn and to know and to dare, and even then, perhaps, to have the wisdom to be silent. Most of all, imagination is this sympathetic magic For whatever we can encompass as a creative experience within ourselves, we become like. We come into sympathy with it. It is like the old story of dreaming true. If we can dream true, we are true. And if we can imagine correctly the measure and proportion of the world, of the human soul, and of the universal mystery, then indeed we possess these things which we have imagined, or perhaps we are possessed by them. Therefore, the training of imagination is of the greatest importance to the young, and release through it is of equal importance to those of older years. Man dies when imagination dies in him. But when it dies, he is willing to settle back into the humdrum and the monotony. But as long as he is challenged by the visions in his own inner life, pressed on to make dreams come true, he finds that the greatest of all arts, magic, is the art of dreaming, and that the scientist and the philosopher are servants of these dreams, helping to make them come true, helping to make real things man has discovered to be possible. However, imagination can also become a terrible enemy, for if it is left untutored and uncultured, it can burden us with extraordinary fears and cause us to regard the whole world around us as something terrible, frightening. It can cause us to face life with the gravest forebodings. Thus, the perfection of imagination is man's release from the misery of his own subjective fear. Creative imagination fills him with hope. Destructive imagination fills him with terror. The training of imagination, therefore, is the sacred art, according to Paracelsus. It is the art of the individual building his dream upon the solid conviction that in the universe all things are good. He uses imagination to find answers which justify life, rather than to develop various attitudes loaded with the sense of injustice or burdened with terror and confusion. Man, wishing to find a world of good around him, can create it out of his own creativity. But if he is convinced that all is ill, evil, sorrowful, he will enforce this into fulfillment in his own life. The creative imagination of Paracelsus is very much like the meditative discipline of the East. It is the problem of the individual gaining skills in the internal visualization of eternal reality. This in itself, according to Paracelsus, is the secret of the human being having the courage to attempt that which may appear, and factually is, impossible. Namely, man's experience of the total life, of the tremendous plan within which he exists. He has no limitation. Perhaps he cannot accomplish all immediately. Perhaps vast time must pass. The spirit man preserves his power to think before himself, to dream beyond achievement, to visualize or envision better and more wonderful states. He will proceed. He will advance. He will move inevitably toward his own perfection. The discriminating of the imaginative faculty, the training of it, therefore, calls into play practically every knowledge that he possesses. From a solid education, he learns certain laws and principles. He becomes aware of the great directions of motion. From the consideration of philosophy, he becomes an ethical creature, strengthening his moral and rational powers, so that his imagination will never escape from that which is valid, and that which invites to progress rather than to chaos. From religion, man gains a powerful symbolism which can vitalize his imagination and can cause him to reach out toward the apperception of deity and the great states of consciousness which transcend our mortal ken. Thus, imagination must be served and directed. And if we wonder what state our own creative faculty may be in, we merely need to consider what it does to us. If as a result of our imagination we are hopeful, inspired, dedicated, then we are moving triumphantly. If, however, imagination has only been an instrument of torture, something that has given us further and more profound doubts on every subject, imagination which has caused us to see the invisible world around us filled with demons and evil spirits, an imagination which causes us to feel that the finger of providence points at us with some negative or terrible malediction. If these things are in the imagination, then they are morbid, and the imagination is untrained but has fallen into delusion. So the positive pole of our creativity is imagination, and the negative pole is delusion. And the individual who finds evil in the divine plan is always deluded. But the individual who finds God in everything has creative imagination. A simple summary of a long and involved discourse, but perhaps it will point the way of his thinking. And perhaps it explains better than almost any formal approach we could make the entire philosophy of the life of Paracelsus. He was born, apparently, with a strange gift of imagining truth. He was able to look around and see in common things wonderful mysteries. He was also able to look out into the mysterious and see in all mysteries common things. To have this wonderful faculty brings the world into a focal condition for us. For all mysteries are simply a simple truth not yet understood. And all simple truths are mysteries that have been grasped, have been estimated and examined. And that which lies beyond our knowledge is not strange, wild, weird, or distant. It is merely simple truth not yet experienced. And we move forward with complete victory into the unknown, realizing that we shall never face a horrible or terrible condition. The only horror or terror that we can know is in our own misunderstanding. The only evil that there is rooted in the selfishness of man. If man can overcome this, he can live proudly in this world, live with the true sense of the dignity of himself and of life and of purpose. This brings us, perhaps, to one of the outstanding examples of the creative concept of Paracelsus, and that is his conviction of the interrelationship between macrocosm and microcosm. We have to realize that this concept did not originate with him. It goes back to a very early time. In fact, we find traces of it in practically all the civilized groups of mankind. Back in ancient times, man was governed by a simple law, the law of analogy. It was inscribed upon the statue of Nebo, the god of wisdom, that stood in the midst of the great Babylonian culture. Nebo was the lord of the writing table, a tablet and stylus were his symbols. He later became identified with the Egyptian soul, who in turn we remember as Hermes. Nebo, upon his ancient tablet, bore the inscription, "What has been, will be. That which is superior is like to that which is inferior. That which is inferior is like to that which is superior. I have spoken. I am Nebo, lord of the writing table." This law of analogy is the foundation of ancient science, and it continued to dominate the thinking of men until the end of the 17th and early years of the 18th century of the Christian era. After that time, the rise of experimental science obscured this total view of man, which was the strength and power of ancient thinking. The concept of man as the universe and the universe as the grand man faded with the rise of those schools of thought which later gave us the Darwinian concept, and after that, the works of men like Huxley and Gene. Actually, however, these men never disproved the law of analogy. They gave us other patterns, yet periodically we find revised in the experimentations of modern science the definite indication that there are these analogical laws, that various levels interrelate, and that on certain levels, certain laws operate consistently. But just as surely as we have octaves in music, so we have octaves in chemistry. That which can be demonstrated upon one level is essentially true upon other levels, although we may not be able immediately to examine these parallels or these common truths. Recognizing, as we've mentioned in the first lecture of this series, that there are three great texts which man may consider in the search for essential knowledge. These being the universe, the sacred word, and the human body. Paracelsus pointed out that the universe is rather too large to be immediately comprehended by anyone. The only approach that we have to the universe is through analogical imagination. Having perceived some smaller operation of nature which is within our understanding, we assume that we have discovered a law operating throughout nature. Thus, the whole concept of natural laws operating without exceptions upon various levels, this concept is founded in analogy. This law of analogy tells us, if we examine into it further, that there must be correspondences in all parts of the universe, and that these correspondences coming together form patterns which can be examined. Paracelsus pointed out that the most suitable and the most proper symbol from which man can learn the most about all things is his own body. This is for several reasons. First of all, because it is a miniature living thing. Man, with his almost incredible power, faculty, functions, is a magnificent structure taken for granted, the depths of which have never been sounded. Man, in his own existence, reveals almost miraculous powers and attributes which have come so commonplace that we ignore them. That is also said, for example, many men have sought throughout the world for the secret of the transmutation of metals. And yet the greatest transmuting process that we can conceive is the process of human digestion. Here we have an amazing situation. Man taking all forms of nutrition into himself, passing them through the alchemy of his own digestive procedure, and ultimately producing therefrom a pure essence of life by which he sustains himself. Although man eats many foods, he never comes to resemble any of them. They are never found again as separate factors anywhere in his constitution. He may live a lifetime upon a single food, yet he will not resemble it. He may mix his diet incredibly and may eat many things that are of doubtful nutrition. Yet all of these different food elements within a certain bond of reason combined pass through a strange digestion and are transformed into something that helps man to live. This something is a pure, invisible essence. This essence, carried through the body by its elaborate and wonderful mechanism, maintains this organism in a relatively healthy state. So here we see the greatest miracle of all, the miracle of man living from food, man actually living from death, for even the grain that is put into the bread is baked, becoming thereby sterile. And yet from this sterile source comes his nutrition. All alchemy, therefore, can be understood, all substances transmuted, all elixirs discovered, if we are ever able to solve the mystery of how man lives from the food that he eats. Here's a simple example of the analogical law in operation. Men may speculate for centuries, thousands of years, in laboratories with dead elements or live elements. But they can never have the same certainty that might come to them were they able to base all their experiments upon a thorough knowledge of the function of the human body. Nor did he stop in his consideration at this point. Every part of man has locked within it secrets, secrets the understanding of which would help man to survive, help man to solve the mysteries of his own existence. Nor should we regard man merely as a physiological mystery or a biological one. Man is also a great economic mystery. And within his body is an infinite system of compensations for labor, compensations entirely beyond the theory of our economic procedure. Yet every workman is worthy of his hire. And in the human body, every workman receives his hire. Every workman is paid not in material coin, but paid in the substance of life upon which it must depend, paid suitably, properly, and promptly, so that there is not one who does not receive the wages which he earns. Also, the human body is an incredible political structure. For with its infinite diversity of parts, each with its own instincts, its own problems, its own requirements for survival, its own insistences, and its inevitable process of surviving if necessary at the expense of other parts. Yet with all this strange, complex, cooperative competition which we find in man, we also have total government. We have a strange democracy enveloped within an absolute autocracy. We have a democracy in which all things must be served, all things must be protected. And we discover, as Paracelsus points out, the actual pattern of autocracy, namely that the true autocrat is the one who sacrifices all to preserve the good of his people. The autocrat is the one who has the privilege of intelligent leadership. And the moment the autocrat in man becomes indifferent to the security of his subjects, the various parts of the body and its functions, immediately these functions are deranged, and the autocrat loses his empire. If human government should be built upon the same strange recognition that it is the inalienable and inevitable duty of all superiors to protect inferiors, that it is the absolute requirement of the strong to defend the weak, because there is not the weakest cell in man's body which must not be defended, or the entire economy is in danger. Thus it is that the leader must serve. And Paracelsus also points out that in a wonderful way, nature has so established this that in many regards, the leader serves without knowing it. Man is not aware of his own benevolence. He is not aware of the fact that in the subconscious processes and autonomic processes of his body, he is guiding and guarding better than he knows. But while his mind is confused and uncertain, he is still contributing rational impulse to the maintenance of his bodily autonomy. Thus, perhaps, whereas man does not know how to rule the world in which he lives, he might learn by relaxing and trying to know how he so successfully learns to rule the world in which he exists as a person, his own body. All these mysteries, mysteries of religion, philosophy, and science, are locked within the microcosm, the miniature, the small pattern of all things which we call man. The Paracelsus followed very largely in the direction of the Neoplatonists in establishing the great concepts of analogy. Paracelsus pointed out that man's sovereignty over himself, his survival as a creature, was only possible because he existed as an internal compound. It was more to man than body. That he realized, and this, of course, most advanced thinkers of the world have conferred. However, there is much more to it than this. To the Paracelsian thinker, the entire story of man is a revelation of invisible causes. Man is like a stream pouring out of the unseen. And just as the great mother of waters, the Yangtze River, makes fertile the plains of China, so this stream pouring out of the root of man makes possible the maintenance of his mind, his emotions, and his body. Man, therefore, is a being like the familiar iceberg, only a small part of which is visible to us, the greater part hidden and concealed by the veil which is forever across the face of Isis. To understand man, therefore, we must take into account these invisible parts of him. And here our creative imagination helps us to supplement the things that we see and know. In the first place, the very functions of man require and inevitably demonstrate a power and an intelligence superior to themselves. If man can think, if a human being can have a destiny, must arise from something greater than body chemistry. Because these separate cells and parts of man do not have the authority which he possesses. And Paracelsus would not acknowledge that the sum of these lesser lives became inevitably and automatically a greater life. In other words, if 1,000 persons, all ignorant, keep together, their common opinion may not be entirely wise. They cannot produce out of themselves a mind superior to their own. But in man, tiny cells, molecules, even electrons, atoms, all these heaping together to form tissue and structure, all conspiring together to form the common body of man. These, by their minglings and by their cooperation, produce a structure which we call man. Paracelsus insisted that this structure was ensouled, that it became the instrument for a power invisible, that these structural parts, the atoms and all the substances and tissues, were like the stones of a house, which when it was built was inhabited by a person, by a living being, who proceeded to adapt this house to his needs, decorate it according to his inclination, and protect and maintain it if he is a prudent and thoughtful householder. From the invisible part of things, there must come this tremendous flow of life. And as we pointed out earlier in this series, this flow of life, while we recognize it almost as a unity, as one tremendous essence, still this flow of life is able to support and sustain an infinite diversity of activities. This again reminds us of the Yangtze River. For along the shores of the river are hundreds of villages, and in each of these villages are people living their lives, fulfilling their purposes, practicing their trade, holding their convictions, worshiping their gods, bringing new life into the world and burying their dead. No two of the persons living along the sides of the river are identical, yet all depend upon the river. Thus, as this stream of life moves into the human body, no two cells will identically react, yet all will be commonly nourished. And Paracelsus carries this on into the level of religion. And he points out that the mystery of God and holiness is a river likewise, that flowing into the hearts of different persons causes each one to be differently but inevitably strengthened, so that each, out of his faith, is strengthened to his own work, yet dependent upon one life, one divine conviction, for the courage and the wisdom to go on to the separate achievement which may be desired. Studying, therefore, this background, this river pouring forever out of space, Paracelsus made considerable use of both the Neoplatonic and the Muslim doctrines relating to these things. He also borrowed much from the Kabbalists, whose ancient speculations concerning the great man of the Zohar fascinated him, because here was this magnificent image, whose body nature is and God's soul. And he beheld the grand man fulfilling its destiny. And he also beheld its parts, all the cells in the universal body. And he numbered man among these cells. Yet as these cells exist and are inevitable, not one human being can be lost. Not one human soul could die without this entire economy being shaken. For there is a certain wholeness, a certain totality, from which there can be no deprivation. Nothing can cease. Everything must change. But this great body to be healthy, this universal body, which is the body and anatomy of the structure of deity, is like our own body. Part of it cannot be sick and part well. For this reason, Paracelsus objected strenuously to the idea of hell. Because he said there could be no place of death and destruction or of eternal punishment in a body which must be healthy in all its parts in order that the universal mystery shall be maintained. So by many byproducts of thinking came to him along the way, perhaps due to his creative imagination, reaching out into principles that he had discovered and applying them to the uncertainties and worries that have afflicted mortals from the beginning. This river, this stream, flowing out of space, passes through three great conditions, according to the Paracelsian concept. And these three conditions correspond essentially with the nature of the universe. Paracelsus, the universe consisted of three parts, which we call stellar, planetary, and elemental, or elementary. The supreme part of the universe corresponded mysteriously to the sphere of the fixed stars, or what we call constellations. Here, of course, the Neoplatonists had borrowed from their master Plato, for it was the belief of Plato that souls coming into generation descended from the Milky Way, which was the birthplace of souls. Paracelsus was not so literal in his thinking, but he declared that in the physical universe, the great stellar diffusion, which we call the cosmic energy or the cosmic space factor, populated with a vast universal population of worlds, and which we recognize primarily only as suns. But this is an analogy to the spiritual source of things. Perhaps he was thinking or had been taught the legend of Muhammad's night journey to heaven, where he ascended through the orbits of the planets and finally went through the door in the ceiling of the sky and passed into the world which is above. Similar thinking is represented in the Apocalypse of St. John and also in the Divine Timander of Hermes. But according to the Paracelsian concept, there is a state or condition of life which we would call today cosmic or universal. This condition of life is a kind of energy in which the stars, all suns in the centers of solar system, the stars like the angels of Faust sing together. But there is a tremendous field, the field of space in which suns grow, and that the great common energy denominator of space itself is this effulgency which sustains the solar orbit. There are thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps millions and hundreds of millions of suns. Each of these is a self-radiant, splendid globe. Each is a light shining in the darkness for aeons of time. Each of these suns is the parent of planets, and they live only because of its light and life. Planets are embryos, only the suns are born. Therefore, the suns are a race of living things inhabiting space, a race from whose compound nature, like the Milky Way, a vast body is formed, a body universal in its dimensions and proportions, with each of the suns a sparkling center of light somewhere in the mysterious nature of infinite being. The radiance of all these suns together, the rays that pour from them, weave together the living, luminous body of the infinite. To Paracelsus, the term spiritual is properly apportioned or attributed to that kind of energy which feeds the suns, feeding them directly, maintaining them in all their infinite splendor and in their infinite diversity. This light is so vast that we can have no concept of it. It sustains not one sun nor even a thousand suns, but blazes out in space far beyond our comprehension, maintaining perhaps as many suns in the sky as there are grains of sand in the earth. This immensity cannot be grasped by our reason, cannot be understood, but it can be imagined. And by this power of imagination, man can conceive of infinite life. And he can conceive of it because he has a little symbol to help him. And that symbol is the night sky, a symbol in which he can see these points of light flickering in the firmament. And he knows that he is living in a world of giants, a world of incredible beings. And he cannot know how these beings fit together, what their patterns are. But he has already, not only through his imagination, but also through certain observations made over a period of thousands of years, he has observed that this great world of suns is not merely spatters. It is not merely a mass of light tossed by some strange universal providence into existence. These suns are races. They are organisms. They are vast social integrations. All these mysterious luminous bodies obey laws, move within the magnificent rhythm of their purposes, sustained and directed not only by infinite life, but by infinite wisdom. So out of all of this vast thinking, Paracelsus formulated his own definition of spirit. Not merely an absolutely invisible, intangible, ghostly energy somewhere in the source of things, but as the supreme, all-enclosing life. He recognized that these suns, each was like a tiny lamp with its root or wick in a common substance. These suns burned not of themselves alone. Their incandescence was due to the fact that they all had a common fuel. And just as man gains a common fuel from water and air, and as breath is possible to him, he lives. So there is a common life, a common air, a common water, a common fuel, which sustains all this vast galaxy of things. And as these suns go on in constellational orders, in vast structures beyond our dreams or our thoughts, there can only be one answer, namely that there is an infinite fuel, an absolute life, that all living things have their final origin in this, and that no form more magnificently reveals this and the great structure of the constellational diffusion. For here, we see the greatest conceivable manifestation of life. Here we see life so vast that our sun and all its planets could be lost in one atom of it. And yet, with all this life, we see law. And we see this vast life moving downward sequentially through order after order, until some part of itself, some minute fragment of its own completeness, sustains the smallest insect, sustains the tiniest cell, and marks truly and inevitably the coming and going of the humblest of tiny things. Thus everything, from the sun to the mote that dances in the light, All these things are part of one endless concatenation or order of life, descending from the vast to the least, and yet permeating all, not only with the nature of life, but with the inevitable desire to live, to carry on, to produce and generate their kind, to have their day in that life, to love that life, whether they know it or not, to sleep when it departs, to awaken when it returns. So to Paracelsus, the simple statement that man's spirit comes from the stars implies that he regards man as rooted in this ineffable energy, in this absolute life, absolute law, absolute wisdom. And from this internal and wonderful contemplation, Paracelsus was able to rescue himself from certain of the theological problems of the time. He lived in a day when men died at the stake for denying that the stars were candlesticks set out to guide late wanderers home at night. Bruno died at the stake because he said the stars were not fashioned primarily for the use of man. Yet even in our more recent and enlightened thinking, we perhaps have not had the imagination to really sense the immensity of this power by which we gather together into the simple word God. Paracelsus sought to give us a larger meaning of this word. He sought to remind us of the true infiniteness of deity. And in this infiniteness, to remind us that we could no longer be dealing with a simple sectarian divinity whose concern was primarily man, and who had forgotten even to provide for the beasts of the fields in his pattern of redemption. This was not conceivable. All things had their places, and man himself was one of the lesser stars strewn in space, all tied together, bound together, in this immense dance of life, this endless rhythm the universe itself. Therefore, if man carries with him into existence this spark, this ray, from the fire altar of the infinite, man has within himself the spiritual darkness of night. He also has the unseen field from which all this energy comes, the dark earth of the unexplored dimensions of matter and time and space. And within this dark earth of the unknown which feeds him as it feeds the stars, man also contains within himself a constellation of luminous points, a tiny sun gleaming and glowing. And if we could see him and understand him totally, we would see that this thing which man calls his spirit is actually a vast constellation of divine light. And that this spirit, with all its sun, with all its magnificent patterns, with its laws and its rules and its divine mathematics, this spirit, could we see it, would be a miniature of the sky at night. If we could look outwards and see the stars in the sky, we would feel that we had ordinary vision. But if we could look inwards and see the dark sky of man, with its infinite constellation, we would then wonder if we would understand Paracelsus, who said that the heavens and the earth are in man. But just as surely as he lives in the midst of the great universal diffusion, if you go deep enough into man, you find this diffusion again. You find that man inwardly is a vast constellation. A constellation not composed of immovable objects, but of these spark suns, rotating, revolving, and moving, and supplying their energy to the planet which they bring into generation. And just as the space around us is filled with suns, the different compositions of which can be determined to a degree at least by the solar spectrograph, so in man, each of these stars in him that form together the jewel of his spirit Each of them is a little different. Each is an instrument for a purpose. Each bears its own planet. Each fashions a world according to its own needs, desires, and laws. Thus, as surely as every sun that we see is potentially capable, at least, of having planets. So, each sun in man is potentially capable of having a planetary family moving about it, a family which exists from its benevolence, and a family which is the unfolding expression of its own life. So, as Paracelsus has pointed out, the spirit comes from the stars, so the soul of man comes from the planet. For the soul of man is like a planetary system moving around the great, matchless altar of the sun. Thus, man, compositely, is also a solar system with a sun in the midst of it. We do not realize it, but could we examine the great sun ball in the sky, it would not be one ball as we think it is. It would be an infinite grouping of luminous, blazing units. In man, the spirit is not just one spiritual essence. It is a magnificent alchemical mystery, a union of spiritual rays and energies forming one vast spiritual flame which we cannot distinguish or separate, but is which contains an infinite number of parts, all resident within its own nature. Around this blazing central light move the children which it has fashioned, the planet. And according to Paracelsus, the planet occupies symbolically and allegorically the place of the world soul. Now, as all suns have their common light and their common field and their common procreativity, yet each sun, once it has come to be a blazing center of light, brings forth from itself its own soul or its own planetary family. And in our particular system, this soul, according to the Paracelsian theory, consisted of seven parts and an eighth or receptive instrument. Thus, he again follows the Neoplatonists, enumerates the eight parts of the soul, again following Pythagoras, who declared the soul to be an octoad, or a symmetrical structure with eight sides. The soul, then, consists of the energy of the sun differentiated through planetary instruments. These instruments are also alive, but these instruments have not yet reached the point in which their internal luminosity gives them the right or the power to be suns. Therefore, planets are growing in space as the soul is, gaining certain strength from within themselves, but still dependent upon the light of the sun, which they reflect. Thus, Paracelsus says, the human soul reflects the light of the spirit. And because it is a reflector of light, those who are not wise assume that it is the source of light, and the source of light. And here we come for a pretty problem for the psychologist. For according to the psychologist, the soul of man is himself. According to Paracelsus, it is not. The soul is no more the source of light than is the planet, the source of the soft glow by which we can see it. This light is reflected from the sun. And bathed in the light of the sun, the planet appears to have a light of its own. In the case of man, the soul, bathed in the light of spirit, seems to be a being. And it is a being of a kind, but not yet as luminous or complete as we would like to think. The soul lives only because of its dependence upon the spirit. And what we call soul powers are the differentiated aspects of spiritual energy. In the Paracelsian concept, therefore, the seven planets known to the peoples of that time, the number is arbitrary, but representative according to him, that in each solar system there may be a different number of planets. But whatever the number may be, that number, by archetype, determines the divisions of the psychic life of things living on that, or in that solar system. Therefore, if another solar system has 10 planets, then the psychic structure of beings in that solar system will have 10 parts. But always this life must be differentiated sequentially, all the way down through the order. And if the beginning of the system is septenary, if the power of the sun of a solar system is septenary, then every creature within that system must unfold according to septenary laws. Now, we may say that we shall discover sometime that we are not a septenary. If that is true, then we will face the problem of integrating our concept that the soul perhaps has more elements than we imagine. If the principle is not disproven, only man's increasing knowledge may give him a fuller comprehension of the details of its application. The soul, according to Paracelsus, therefore, is a very strange and wonderful thing. The soul is between the spirit and the body. It is composed of substances which have their origin, like the origin of planets, in the common matter of things. But it is also receiving into itself and disseminating very markedly and powerfully the spiritual energy of the sun itself. Therefore, soul is a messenger of spirit. It is an extension of spirit. But it is more than this. It is a strange compound. For within its nature, the soul also possesses the principles and rudiments of matter. Thus, the soul is an immortal mortal, or immortal immortal. It is represented by the interlaced equilateral triangle, indicating the equilibrium of divine or causal and material or effectual factors. The soul, therefore, receives from the body a certain heritage. It receives from the spirit a certain heritage. And in this middle distance where the soul is, the true humanity of man is established. When the breath of life was breathed into man, he became a living soul. This, Paracelsus pointed out, has generally been ignored. We have assumed that man is an ensouled body. Actually, to the Paracelsian thinker, this is not true. To him, man is a soul inhabiting a body. If the soul has an existence of its own nature, and that man is actually a citizen of the universe of soul, the body is an accidental or incidental condition. Body is a process in nature by which soul becomes involved in the mystery of generation. It takes upon itself a material structure. But the moment the human being is born, he begins to fight again for his estate as a soul. And when he reaches maturity, we call this maturity the triumph of soul over body in the individual. We have a simpler word for it. We say he is mature. When we say a person is mature, we mean that his mental and emotional nature is capable of directing his life. To say this means the victory of the psychic field over the material, and the perpetual adolescent or the retarded individual is one in which this victory is not so easily or rapidly achieved. Actually, therefore, a materialist or a person who is unaware or non-receptive to the concept of soul must still be, regardless of whether he knows it or not, a soul in a body. The soul is the significant part of man. For it is that part of man which contains within it the reason, the intuition, the emotion, and the magical power of imagination. If, therefore, we have to try to establish man as a citizen of some world, we would say that his natural residence is in the psychic atmosphere, that he is really living and evolving as a soul creature. To overlook this or to deny it, to fail to recognize it, is to narrow the opportunity of human life. It is to restrict us unnecessarily. And when we are so restricted and accept the negative factor, becoming obsessed by a kind of ignorance, then we may devote our lives merely to the perpetuation of body. We may concern ourselves totally with material things at the expense of our own soul nature. If we do so, we will simply retard the natural growth of the soul or make slower its evolution and failing to cooperate with it. Paracelsus has an idea in here which may be a little strange to many people. I have tried to trace it, and I've come to the conclusion that he derived it from the old Egyptian philosophy. And in this case, in all probabilities, it came through Neoplatonism to a degree, although it is not emphasized. Certainly it is dependent somewhat upon the Gnostics, but more directly upon the later Egyptian or Hermetic mysteries that flourished about the beginning of the Christian era. Paracelsus held, and Dehmi, the German mystic, followed him in the same thinking. But man, in a strange way, must earn immortality. In other words, the human being, though composed of immortal elements that are unchanging and inevitable, to attain conscious immortality, must become consciously alive in the sphere of soul. That if the soul does not receive sufficient development and maturing during life, it is not capable of maintaining consciousness after death. This was the attitude of